Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. October 12, 2019 was a gray, foggy day in Vienna. Thousands of people were lining the streets to witness a moment in sports history.
Here he goes. And listen to the crowd react.
All eyes were on Eliud Kipchoge, one of the world's greatest long-distance runners. He had already won gold at the Rio Olympics and set a world record at the 2018 Berlin Marathon. But now, he was looking to accomplish something long thought impossible. Running a full marathon, that's 26.2 miles, in under 2 hours.
This is amazing to see. As a fan of the sport, this is unreal. This is special. We're witnessing history.
People in the running world had been discussing this for years as marathon records crept closer and closer to the two-hour mark. As the Kenyan long-distance runner closed in on the final 300 meters, he held up one finger.
He's pointing. Come on, he says.
He made it with 20 seconds to spare.
A barrier once thought impossible is now broken. Eliud Kipchoge is the first sub-2-hour marathoner.
This was not an ordinary marathon, though. This was a highly engineered event. There were no other competitors, just Kipchoge against the clock. But he did have a small army of world-class runners with him, serving as pace setters, arranged in a V to minimize the impact of wind. A car drove in front of them, projecting a laser to set the pace. Add to that years of innovation to shave off a few seconds here and there, new diets and training techniques, more efficient ways to hydrate. And soon after the celebrations were over, there was controversy over what had really been achieved here. Scientific advances are constantly propelling athletes forward, pushing the limits to be faster, better, stronger. Studies into athletes' minds help gain advantages in performance, remaining calm under pressure, recovering after defeat. But there's often a nagging question. Is this still about athletic ability, or is it science claiming the victory? On today's show, how science is shaping sports. Let's start with a closer look at Eliud Kipchoge's record-breaking run, which many people argued was all engineered by science. There was one factor that seemed to especially irk critics: Kipchoge's shoes. He was wearing a prototype of Nike's Vaporfly running shoes. More than 2 years later, the controversy over these sneakers has not gone away. In fact, it's kicked off what some in the running world are calling an arms race in running shoes. Liz Tung has more.
When Jeff Burns was 13 years old, he sliced open one of his own running shoes, a pair of white and black Nike Pegasus. His goal? He wanted to see how they worked.
You know, they said they had full-length air, and so, you know, I'm like, well, what does full-length air look like?
That's Nike's trademark cushioning system. It was supposed to be the shoe's secret weapon, and Jeff envisioned it as something like a big fluffy pillow. But that's not what he found.
I actually ended up being quite disappointed. It looks almost like Keebler crackers. It's like essentially just a little pad with small amount of air. And I looked at him like, what? This doesn't seem like it does anything.
Despite that somewhat disappointing discovery, Jeff remained fascinated with running shoes. Today, he's easily one of the biggest experts out there when it comes to the biomechanics of shoes. He's a sports scientist and engineer physiologist currently doing postdoctoral research at the University of Michigan's Performance Research Lab. He also happens to be a world-class ultramarathon runner.
Yeah, so the first big innovations that came in running shoes were the invention of polymer foams.
Foamed rubber first came on the scene in the 1960s, and right away, it was a game changer. Up until that point, running shoes were pretty low-tech. Think Keds or Converse. They had flat rubber soles and very little support. Some were even made of leather. But this new foam, in particular a kind called EVA that appeared in the 70s, was light and cushiony, which Jeff says was a key upgrade.
Humans like a little bit of cushioning underneath their feet when they run.
It's not only comfier, it actually makes running easier.
A lab at the University of Colorado put together this nice kind of series of studies and hypothesis around this that they call the metabolic cost of cushioning. You know, our bodies, when we land, essentially need to do our muscles and tendons, they do that cushioning for us. And that's part of the cost of running, of each step. And so if we can offload that cost to some material, we can save a little bit of energy. So that EVA served that function, to give us that little bit of cushioning to allow us to then use more of our metabolic energy to, you know, to go forward.
It was a huge innovation. It led not only to modern sneakers, but to modern running as we know it. But that's where advancements in running shoes kind of stalled. Over the next 4 to 5 decades, shoe companies from Nike to Reebok to Adidas experimented tirelessly. They tried out different materials, different designs, different gimmicks. But for the most part, manufacturers remained stuck on the same recipe and seemed to hit a bit of a performance ceiling. Until, that is, 2017, when Jeff first heard murmurings about Nike's newest shoe.
Yeah, the first time that I heard about it was actually in the lead up to Nike's Breaking 2 project. It was in 2017, this attempt to run a marathon distance under 2 hours.
This was Eliud Kipchoge's first attempt at breaking the 2-hour barrier.
And they were going through all of these innovations that they were doing, and one of them was the shoe.
It was a shoe that Nike had designed specifically for the event, called the Vaporfly. A few months later, they released a consumer version called the Vaporfly 4%, so named because it purportedly improved runners' performance by 4%. As always, there were skeptics. But then a study came out of the University of Colorado showing that the claim was true. The Vaporfly really did help improve performance by as much as 4%, which may not sound like much, but can make a major difference when it comes to marathons. I should add that the study was sponsored by Nike, but Jeff says this is one of the top biomechanics labs in the world. And on top of that, their data was sound. So how did the shoe work? Jeff says it comes down to energy savings, how much energy or oxygen you're using to go a certain speed.
In running, we call that the running economy. So that's efficiency, miles per gallon.
Or rather, liters of oxygen per kilometer run. When you run more efficiently, you get to spend less energy on every step. And when you do that, you have more energy to make you run faster. Here's where the shoes come in. Every time your foot hits the ground, your muscles have to spend some energy to cushion the impact. The reason modern sneakers were such a big deal is that the foam cushioning offloaded some of that work to the shoes, saving some of that energy for running. But shoes were limited by how much of that soft foam they could add. Because more foam means a heavier shoe, which costs more energy to carry on the foot. Also, and importantly, while the old foam, the EVA, squished down and lessened the impact, they weren't very good at squishing back, which meant that a little bit of energy was still being lost in each step. Theoretically, by adding foam that still squishes down but provides a greater energy return, you could make the runner more efficient. Something shoe companies have been striving for years. And with the Vaporfly, it looked like Nike had solved that problem. The answer? A new kind of foam called PBAX.
It is softer than other foams, so it squishes down a lot more. It's more resilient than other foams, which means it has more energy return. So the energy that you put into the ground and squish on the foam when you land, it gives a lot more of that back, so you can recycle some of the energy that you were using. And it's less dense, which means it's lighter than EVA.
Traditional sneakers offer a return on energy of about 60 to 65%. The Vaporfly, as much as 85%.
So it was a big jump up. And of course, softer, which meant that for a given force, you squish down and store a lot more energy than the EVA. So you can store more energy and you get more back. And then, you know, after having your cake and eating it too, you can go back for seconds because it's lighter, so it costs less to carry.
That meant they could pile way more of this soft, squishy foam into the shoe to help release more energy. But here's the thing. The more foam you have, the more unstable the shoe. Which brings us to the Vaporfly's second big innovation, a carbon fiber plate, which basically provided stability or architecture for the foam. So that was it. The Vaporfly was softer, lighter, and had a higher energy return.
And so I heard all of these things. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's the holy triumvirate.
Pretty soon, the Vaporfly was proving itself out on the track. In 2019, the top 10 runners in the Chicago Marathon all wore Vaporflies.
And it'll be Lawrence Chirono winning in Chicago.
As did Bridget Kosgei, who demolished the Women's World Marathon record by a full 81 seconds.
Bridget Kosgei will defend her Chicago Marathon championship and shatter the world record in the marathon.
Record that had stood for 16 years. It seemed like science had won the day, but that did not sit well with everyone. To critics, these achievements weren't about athleticism or even the sport itself. They were about technology.
There was immediately controversy,
including claims of what critics started calling mechanical doping.
Controversy over a high-tech running shoe called the Nike Vaporfly.
They've ignited a fierce debate about whether the Vaporflies should be banned from competition. Critics say the sneakers provide an unfair advantage to those who race in them.
It's turned what is effectively a foot race into an arms race.
Called the Vaporflies technological doping.
I wouldn't hesitate to use the word.
Do you think these shoes count as mechanical doping?
If we think about the term mechanical doping, I think we need to maybe define what doping is. If it's artificially augmenting performance, yes, they do that. If it's cheating, no, they're not cheating. So if doping is cheating, no. If doping is enhancing performance, yes. So it depends on which class you fall there.
If you ask Jeff, the fact is that scientific advances and ever-improving gear have been a part of modern running since it became modern running, thanks in part to the innovation of foam-cushioned running shoes.
And I think that's one of the really interesting things about this is that, yeah, we talk about are people okay with equipment, i.e. shoes, changing their performance, and it really always has, from the sense that putting shoes on is an advantage over not wearing shoes for most people.
Since the Vaporfly's release, other shoe companies started putting out their own super shoes. And soon, critics were pushing World Athletics, the international governing body for competitive running, to set some rules that would ban or at least limit this growing arms race of super shoes. But for the most part, World Athletics stayed quiet.
The only regulation that was in place was that footwear could not construe any sort of mechanical assistance or advantage. That's not even a rule. It's like a mission statement or something like that. It's not objective.
They needed guidelines that were clear, straightforward, and easy to enforce. So in 2019, Jeff decided to put forward his own proposal in the British Journal of Sports Medicine. That is, to regulate footwear based solely on its thickness.
So I thought, you know, why not just simply regulate the gross geometry of the shoe, how thick it is? So fundamentally speaking, that's limiting the physical extent to which you can add something onto your body and then optimizing within that space. So it kind of is this compromise between innovation as well as restricting the extent to which something can move performance forward.
The letter got a lot of traction. And in 2020, World Athletics finally announced new rules that sneakers couldn't have soles that exceeded 40 millimeters, about an inch and a half, and also could not have more than one carbon plate. Another stipulation, the shoes have to be available on the market at least 4 months before the competition, all of which would have made Eliud Kipchoge's famous sub-2 prototype shoes illegal. But other Nike super shoes remain sanctioned for competition. And Jeff says he doubts we'll see any more major leaps in running shoe technology in the near future. Though he says we probably still don't know all the ways super shoes in general are affecting the sport. So for now, the world of running will have to keep on living with super shoes. because it looks like they're here to stay.
Some people love the technology side and advancing it. And I think that's something that's existed for a long time in other endurance sports like cycling, where equipment plays a huge role. But I think one of the problems is that running was actually a haven for a lot of people that liked the, I'll be pretentious and call it the purity of the sport. But that's what running was, is it really is the simplest form of physical competition. And so this really disrupted that. And it shifted that pure physical performance. And it's something that some people are excited about and some people lament.
That story was reported by Liz Tung. We're talking about the impact of science on sports. Innovations in material science are powering all kinds of new gear and equipment beyond super sneakers. There are faster ice skates, sleeker swimsuits created thanks to NASA research, more powerful tennis rackets.
I mean, I'm older, so we had like wooden tennis rackets when I was a kid. Now they're made out of nanotechnology and graphene, and you get much more bounce off the ball. And so the returns are faster, and all of that is because of science.
That's Jennifer Swanson. She's the author of The Secret Science of Sports.
You think that they've reached the edge of the technology, and then someone comes out with something else. The one sport where I've seen like a huge explosion of technology is golf. The golf balls themselves, the golf clubs, every part of the golf club has changed because of technology. And now you're seeing players hit further and longer and higher. So it's all beneficial to the athlete. It just helps them give it a little extra edge that perhaps they wouldn't have had if they were using equipment from, say, 50 years ago.
What are the golf balls made of and the clubs that makes them so much better?
So there's so many different materials. And a lot of that, I will say, is proprietary. But a lot of them are made with nanotechnology, which is the science of the extremely small. And they're just getting better and better and better about manipulating materials at that level. Some of them, they want to be flexible. Some of them, they want to be strong. So they can be made of graphene. They can be made of carbon nanotubes, stuff like that. And that allows you to have these really strong swings, which all of the golfers do. And if you have something lighter, like say the shaft itself is lighter, but the head of the club is stronger, physics says that should make the ball fly farther.
That's Jennifer Swanson, author of The Secret Science of Sports, the math, physics, and mechanical engineering behind every Grand Slam, triple axel, and penalty kick. Coming up, neuroscientists are trying to get into athletes' heads, but it's difficult.
And if anybody has been inside an MRI machine, you know that you're not kicking soccer balls in one of those things.
That's next on The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about how science is shaping sports. What exactly is going on inside of an athlete's brain while they compete? Studying that is challenging because measuring brain activity requires being tethered to equipment or being inside of an MRI machine.
And if anybody has been inside an MRI machine, you know that you're not kicking soccer balls in one of those things.
That's journalist Zach Schoenbrunn. As a sports writer, he became interested in the work of two neuroscientists at Columbia University, Jason Sherwin and Jordan Moraskin. They were trying to measure what was happening inside of baseball players' heads, despite the limits of the available technology.
So they started with the Columbia baseball team. They designed a video game simulation, very basic, from a batter's perspective, of a ball coming toward the hitter, and it was literally just a single ball against a green screen coming toward you.
And they asked these batters to make a decision on whether or not they were going to swing at this particular pitch. Participants would push one button to say, yes, I would swing at this, another button to signal no swing, all while connected to an EEG to capture their brain activity.
It's essentially like a, you know, metallic swim cap or a hairnet with 9 or 12 electrodes that are making contact with the scalp using a sort of conductive electrode cream.
Zach says baseball is a pretty good starting place for this kind of research.
Especially when it comes to hitting, right? Hitting a baseball is a binary decision. It's, do I swing or not? Does this pitch look like something I want to swing at, yes or no? And that decision can be registered along the timeline of a pitch based on brain activations.
So this experiment was nothing like being on the field, swinging at a real fastball with an actual bat. But capturing the player's brain activity still revealed some interesting information.
They were able to detect actual differences in the timing that expert hitters were making decisions on whether to swing or not swing at a pitch versus novices. From there, they actually were able to figure out and determine differences even within Columbia's own lineup of hitters about when those decisions were being made about whether to swing or not swing at a pitch. And so, you know, that was kind of the first real inkling that there might be some differences in brain response between expert hitters, not just between versus novices, but also differentiating themselves among each other. And so getting a peek underneath the hood, underneath the helmet for the first time at great athletes was a pretty breakthrough opportunity.
Zach says getting a better sense of brain activity could help shed some light on why some athletes excel and others don't.
There's plenty of examples of players that seem to have the perfect physical form, physical traits to succeed in the sport, but for some reason things weren't clicking mentally or cognitively. Now you have access to brain signals or brain data that's showing that maybe their decision-making isn't quite up to par versus others who are on their team.
Zach says this is all still very new, and it will likely take a while to catch on.
I think the thing that to understand is the sports industry is kind of broken down into two major parties, right? You have the players, the athletes themselves, and you have the owners and the management. Now, the owners and the management, they're solely focused on winning, right? And for in a lot of cases, certainly professional sports, they have the budgets, they have an unlimited amount of money to be able to spend on whatever projects or pursuits or science, sports science businesses that they feel could help them win. What they don't have in abundance is time. And so the opportunity cost of going in one direction versus another is something that they have to very carefully weigh. I think the brain is in a lot of cases the missing factor into understanding what's going on with performance and why some athletes are excelling and some athletes might not be. But the tools that we have to reliably understand that probably aren't quite there yet. So teams have to weigh, is this piece of equipment that I'm hooking my guys up to, is that worth the time versus just spending more time in the weight room or at batting practice?
But Zach says eventually this kind of research could lead to a deeper understanding of what makes great athletes, beyond their physical attributes. He gave me an example from the 2017 American League MVP race,
which came down to Aaron Judge of the New York Yankees and Jose Altuve of the Houston Astros, two athletes, two players who could not be more polar opposite physically. Altuve is 5'5", maybe, and Aaron Judge is 6'7" and a strapping muscular build. And so if you're a team and you're saying, I want my scouts to find the next Aaron Judge, well, you're probably going to end up missing all the next Jose Altuves. And so I think having access to what really is going on that is making up for their success I think is that missing piece in scouting, and will probably erase a lot of frustrations that scouts have in trying to find the next great star.
That's Zach Schoenbrunn. He is the author of The Performance Cortex: How Neuroscience is Redefining Athletic Genius. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about how science is changing sports. In baseball, the home plate umpire has one of the most important jobs on the field, calling balls and strikes.
That pitch has been a strike, and it has not been a strike.
That's a called strike three on a pitch that was nowhere near the zone. Escobar.
Sometimes these calls are controversial, and they lead to heated arguments.
And again, what's he have to do, he said.
In 2019, the Atlantic League made headlines when they started using robot umpires, a computerized system that determines when a pitch is a ball or a strike. Could robot umpires take human error out of these game-changing moments? Or would this take the tension and some of the fun out of the game? Alan Yu looked into it.
Anthony Peroni says he was born to play baseball.
I derive from a baseball family. My father played baseball, and, you know, it's kind of in my blood. I've played ever since I was four.
His father was a catcher, and so is he. Anthony is a professional player for the Lancaster Barnstormers, a Pennsylvania team in the Atlantic League.
There's a pitcher out there that really put all his faith in you to call the game, and that goes well for you as a catcher. It's an unmatched feeling.
He plays for those moments of receiving a pitch, especially the pitches that could be considered a ball or a strike.
That's a big part of why I am the catcher I am, is receiving. So I like stealing strikes. I enjoy having good relationships with the umpires and really starting to understand their zone.
Stealing strikes is when a ball is so close to the border of the strike zone that the way Anthony catches the ball can influence whether the umpire calls it a ball or a strike. It's almost like a sleight of hand. When a batter steps up to home plate, the umpire determines the strike zone, and it can change depending on the batter and their stance. The strike zone is the area over home plate, from the midpoint between a batter's shoulders and the top of the uniform pants to just below the kneecap. Or as umpire Fred DeJesus puts it,
17-inch plate from the hollow of the knee to the nipple line. That is the strike zone. That is what the rule book states.
Fred has been an umpire in the Atlantic League for 14 years. During a typical game, umpires make more than 100 calls.
It's a grind, so, you know, it's rules application with mechanics and judgment.
Deciding whether a ball is in the strike zone or not can lead to big arguments with players.
I've had the opportunity to throw out Jose Canseco.
He just got ejected. This is worth the price of admission right here.
Jose was not happy with the pitch. He showed his displeasure. I threw him out, and he went on to discuss, you know, for 25 minutes of how I should not be working that level of baseball.
A bad call from an umpire can change the game. It can mean a runner advances on base, strikes out, or even an undeserved win or a loss. As you may imagine, umpires sometimes make controversial calls that lead to people yelling at them during a game and quite a while afterwards. That's mainly why in 2019, the Atlantic League introduced what they call the automated ball strike system, a machine that will tell an umpire whether a ball was in the strike zone or not. There are multiple cameras and radar devices, including one behind home plate connected to a computer. Instead of relying on an umpire's eyes to judge what the strike zone is, the automated system generates a strike zone for a hitter based on how tall a player is, and watches for the moment when a ball crosses the strike zone. An operator sits at a computer to make sure the system knows who the batter is at any time. After each pitch, the computer sends the call to the umpire, who is wearing an earpiece. The human umpires can overrule what the computer says if they disagree. Rick White, president of the Atlantic League, says this system addressed the number one suggestion he got from players, coaches, and managers.
I don't care what the strike zone is. I want umpires to be consistent.
When Fred, the umpire, first heard about this new system, he was not happy.
I said, no way, I'm not working.
He had spent thousands of dollars and gained years of training and experience to become an umpire, and now a machine was going to take over a major part of his job. But then Fred tried the system a few times during practice and came around to it, partly because it meant fewer people yelling at him.
It's a growing part of the game, just like instant replay, and one day it'll be in the big leagues.
Rick says that makes the system a success.
It took away the sniping that comes from the bench during a game with coaches, managers, and players complaining about ball and strike calls. Now, you know, with this system being utilized, umpires could turn to the dugout, they could shrug their shoulders, point up to the press box and say, it's the system, it's not me. So if you've got a problem, you're technically arguing with the machine.
Even though the system worked, Rick White says it will no longer be used in the Atlantic League, in part because Major League Baseball was paying for the experiment and the funding dried up. If money were not an issue, he would have liked to keep the system around. But this is not the end of robot umpires. It may be just the beginning. Major League Baseball considered it successful enough that they are taking the automated system to AAA, the closest level to the major leagues, to test it further. Our umpire Fred and catcher Anthony both see the automated system as the future of baseball, which Anthony has mixed feelings about.
With the automated system, it didn't really matter how you presented the pitch, how you caught the pitch, really anything at all. You know, that pitch, whether it crossed that box or not, was going to be called a strike or a ball regardless of how I caught it. So, you know, it kind of just wiped out that whole aspect of the game, and you know, you were just at the mercy of the system.
That means less wiggle room for stealing strikes. His teammate, pitcher Dominic DeSabatino, says how a catcher catches a pitch is the game.
If they continue to use this, there's just no human error aspect of it, and that's the game of baseball.
Alva Noe feels more strongly about this.
It's a solution to a problem that doesn't exist.
He is not a baseball player, but a philosopher at the University of California, Berkeley. He is also a big baseball fan and wrote a book called Infinite Baseball. He says the problem with the automated system is that it rests on a literalist view of what the umpire does. He says there is a reason that, unlike in tennis, you do not have lines marking where a ball is allowed to be. In his opinion, baseball umpires are not just strike zone measuring machines.
What the umpire is trying to decide is, should the batter have hit that pitch? Can we blame the batter for not having hit that pitch? The question that the umpire faces is never, where was the ball, but rather, should the batter have been able to hit it? And that requires judgment. That doesn't require measurement.
Alva says that is a human judgment that requires not just knowledge of the rules, but also the context of what's going on in a particular game and how people are playing.
There's a kind of deep conceptual mistake in the idea of the robot umpire. The idea that you would eliminate the umpire from that situation is like eliminating jurists and judges from the courtroom in the interests of impartiality.
And that would make baseball a different game, according to Dominic, the pitcher.
The whole learning curve for guys that have been playing this game for a very long time and having to have them change their style of pitching, or catchers having to have new game plans when they're calling pitches for pitchers, and then the hitters having to relearn their strike zone, learning about what pitches they can swing at, what pitches they can't, I think will change the game tremendously.
Some techniques just would not work anymore, like stealing strikes. How you feel about that would come down to whether you think human tricks and quirks like that are examples of unfairness or just part of the game.
That story was reported by Alan Yu.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity.
The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about how science is shaping sports. Lots of factors fuel athleticism: ability, strength, training, gear, nutrition. But a big part of what makes winners and losers is the head game, focus, and an athlete's command of their emotions. Reporter Jads Lehmann looked into the role emotions play in athletes' performance.
Mixed martial arts seems angry. It's a literal cage fight where knees and elbows fly alongside kicks and punches, where hitting the opponent when they're down is just part of the match.
With that stoppage, his face was a bloody mess. Look at this display. On top, ground and pound from beginning to end. Carl Amasu opened up so badly.
Tempers flare well before the fight even starts, when opponents meet in front of the press.
He should have killed me when he had the chance, because now I'm back and I'm going to kill you and your whole team. You and them kids.
That's Conor McGregor screaming past Joe Rogan at opponent Nate Diaz. UFC flyweight Roxanne Modafferi takes an entirely different approach.
I'm the happy warrior, so I smile at them and I wish them a good fight and I say, like, let's have a great battle, you know, that's what I say.
But she's watched all these other fighters fly into rages during the pre-fight.
I'm going to kill them and I'm going to smash their skulls open. Like, oh, I was like, oh, they're for sure using anger, you know what I mean? Like when they start like talking about how they're going to bloodily mutilate their opponents, I was like, okay, for sure they're using anger.
Using anger as a way to get motivated, to win, to get into the spirit for a fight, Roxanne calls that using the dark side.
I know that my best friend Serena always is like, yeah, anger, blah, blah, blah. Like she always was like, I'm the dark side. I'm like, all right, well, I don't really agree with that. Like, you know, they always say that, you know, anger, it unhinges you and you shouldn't fight with anger. But then some people say, I use anger. I'm like, all right, what is this?
So she asked other fighters what exactly they were feeling or trying to feel when they were actually in a bout. And what she found surprised her.
So nobody like loses control and swings for the fences. It's like everyone I interviewed feels aggression to go beat up their opponent, but they don't actually feel angry when they're fighting. And that was like all across the board.
Roxanne says aggression and anger are not quite the same things. Aggression can motivate you. Anger on its own can be a liability.
For example, one guy, Sean Dodaro, said that when he got hit really hard in training by some like new guy, he got angry and then started fighting harder, but he kind of lost control.
Roxanne, for her part, tries to feel nothing at all during a fight.
I felt it once or twice when I realized I was losing the fight. I'm like, oh no, I start feeling like despair. But that was like once or twice in my 50-fight career. Like, I never feel emotions in the fight, and I kind of like that. And I call myself a Jedi. You know, Jedi are supposed to feel no emotions when they fight. Look up the Jedi Code. It's in there.
And she says all that trash talking other fighters do, even the mutilate and kill your family kind, that may be more often an attempt to get your opponent angry, to get into their head, which could cost them the fight.
So sport fighters are trained to do these techniques in the heat of the moment, and I think that we have good control over our emotions and can use controlled aggression well.
When it comes to emotion in sport, the name of the game seems to be control. You ride the emotions. Don't let them ride you.
Can't finish. And you saw Jordan right there complaining.
If you watch the Chicago Bulls documentary, The Last Dance, it's striking how often Jordan seems to conjure all these wild excuses to get mad.
Most people notice that he would be like, yeah, this guy shook my hand after a game and that made me mad. And then the next story was, that guy didn't shake my hand after a game and that made me mad.
That's Brian Baxter, a performance psychologist at Amplify Sport Psychology in Portland, Oregon.
And there's a line in a Rage Against the Machine song where the singer says, anger is a gift.
Anger is a gift.
And, you know, he's, of course, talking about, you know, being socially aware, active, or politically. And the anger makes you take action.
Brian helps athletes harness their emotions to feel what they need to feel to perform their best. And sometimes that feeling is anger.
I'm working with a high school basketball player right now who, it's like, yeah, people around me tell me that they want to see, you know, angry Joe. And not just Joe, they want to see angry Joe. And so he's like, but I don't know always how to get angry.
The athletes who come to him have basically plateaued somewhere. No matter how they train or how hard they go, they don't seem to get the performance they want. That's where the mental, the emotional side of things can tip the scales. One of the things that comes into play here is something called the Yerkes-Dodson Law. It speaks to the relationship between pressure and performance.
Yeah, that's the inverted U is how I learned it, which basically says that as arousal or anxiety increases, your performance increases to a point, or like a bell curve.
You want emotion, but not too much, to perform at your best. How much emotion and which emotion is right varies for each athlete, but too much of it, too much intensity, and you start going down the bell curve. Harnessing the potentially volatile power of emotions to your advantage is a bit of a tightrope walk, and so is researching all of this. Grace Giles is a research psychologist at the U.S. Army Combat Capabilities Development Command Soldier Center. She's not interested in how anger and other emotions affect combat sports, but more how it affects actual combat. War, sporting events, what they have in common is stress and the things we feel under stress. Grace tries to induce emotions in people and see how their performance is affected. It turns out getting someone angry in the lab without getting them too angry is tricky business.
We've had individuals leave the lab fairly upset, so we typically do negative emotion reversal and so show a funny film clip at the end to make sure that individuals are walking out of the lab feeling a little better.
But usually the problem is subjects don't stay angry long enough for researchers to measure their performance while angry. Scientists use this method where they'll show a certain video clip meant to anger or scare somebody.
War scenes, we've used Band of Brothers in the past to induce fear or negative emotions. News about school bullying to induce anger.
And then to stretch out that feeling, they play music at certain tempos that research shows helps keep the feeling alive. The emotions we feel or suppress can be useful or harmful in different situations and intensities. Grace and her team are trying to zero in on the emotional sweet spots of different aspects of performance. Do you need your anger at a 3 or at a 7 to perform at your best? Another wrinkle to this is the individual variability. The anger that fuels one soldier or mixed martial artist can burn down another. Roxanne, the mixed martial arts fighter, has felt like she's been in a bit of a rut lately.
Boom! Right hand over the top. Look at the left eye of Mata Ferry. It's got a big bruise. You can see some swelling starting to develop.
Now, my issue is that I've been training for this upcoming fight, but I'm not really enjoying it. And I'm like kind of bummed out a lot because I don't have the training partners that I used to have and a lot of other things I won't tell you about.
But she isn't interested in trying to harness anger to get her back in the game.
I'm like, man, like I used to be so happy. And I feel like I wonder if I'll have a better performance if I'm more happy. I'm trying to make changes in my daily life and like train more with friends to kind of like elevate my happiness level, because I feel like that might affect me. I don't want to lose my next fight, so I'm trying to do things to like make me happier.
To get happy, Roxanne is doing jujitsu, another fighting discipline.
Yeah, I miss jujitsu, and I don't do it the way I like to do it. So like this past week, I kind of blew off my MMA practice to do the jujitsu class that I really wanted to do that probably wouldn't help my fight preparation, but it made me really, really happy, like to tears.
That story was reported by Jad Slayman. Roxanne Mataferi has since retired from mixed martial arts after her last fight this month. She lost that last battle, but true to form, she said she was happy afterwards.
I'm really, really happy. Like, as a martial artist, my goal is to really show that I've gotten stronger. Like, I train every day because I want to get stronger. And I was able to fight with a mental clarity that I've never had before. And I really, really wanted it. And that was one of my goals. And I wanted to leave the octagon saying, I got stronger because I trained really hard. And I did. So I'm happy.
We're talking about the impact of science on sports. Performance coach Taylor Johnson gets a lot of data on his athletes' mental performance every moment they are in the game.
So from the neuroscience side, you're looking at perception, cognition, and motor skills.
That's because Taylor now trains e-athletes after a football coaching career in college and the NFL. E-athletes are competing in video games like first-person shooter games, think Call of Duty or Apex Legends.
It could range from team games where it's like 5 versus 5. It could be teams of 6. It could be individual games. But essentially, they're competing at a very, very high level on these incredibly strategic and tactical games with technology. So it's not like your traditional sport where you're playing on a court, a field, an arena. You're playing and the gear of choice is going to be your gaming PC or console.
The competitions are huge events that draw big crowds. There's a lot of money in this for good players. Taylor was drawn to this very different world while he was still coaching in the NFL. He liked being able to get so much real-time data, allowing him to analyze players' performances. And he admired their endurance and strategic abilities.
And that's one of the things that I was struck by with these young individuals being incredibly talented and incredibly intellectual. And the amount of cognitive output that they have on a daily basis is really impressive.
Taylor says he helps e-athletes improve their reaction time and their ability to deal with so many stimuli at once. And there's also the emotional aspect. How do you help players cope with frustration? Like when I watch people play video games, I often observe that they seem to get uniquely frustrated when the game is not going well and then, you know, things get thrown. There is some kind of like anger and frustration that gets blown off that I would think would be really disruptive to your performance.
Yeah, so that's called tilting. And yeah, so individuals will tilt, and that's basically where they get frustrated with how the game's going. They may lash out and, you know, scream and yell, or they may actually internally just shut down. And yeah, I work with a lot of players and coaches on that. And really it's around like, what is your mental game? A lot of that has to do with preparation. A lot of that has to do with intentions. And then the biggest part of it all is emotional regulation. And like, how well do I know myself in different situations, and how quickly can I learn how I respond or react? Because there's a distinction. So a big coaching distinction is, are you going to respond or react? Because a react is an emotional response. You know, when I react to something, sometimes it might be out of anger or fear, whatever it may be. But if I respond, that means I'm able to process and choose how I want to respond to it. So there's a subtle difference there.
So what do I do if I'm about to tilt?
Well, I mean, one of the easiest things to do is just breathe. You know, like if you ever notice yourself in a certain situation where you start to get tense and agitated and a wave of emotions comes about, you know, your breath might shorten, you know, you might have a tightness in your chest. And so what I always encourage players to do is, you know, one is drop your tongue from the roof of your mouth. Because if you ever notice your self-talk, you drive your tongue into the top of your mouth. And if you can remove that, the chatter tends to limit itself. And then breathe, big inhale through your nose and then slow exhale through your nose.
Oh, that's funny about the tongue. I never thought about that.
Yeah. Did you notice?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I picked that up from one of my mentors. He'd be like, hey, man, you know, if you're in your head, drop your tongue from the roof of your mouth. And I'm like, whoa, I had no idea. Because you're not verbally talking, so your tongue's got to do something because you have internal chatter. So that tends to help.
That's great. That's esports performance coach Taylor Johnson. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can check us out wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Marcus Biddle is our health equity fellow. Our intern is Sarah Kirsten. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.